This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. قُلْ إِن تُخْفُوا مَا فِي صُدُورِكُمْ أَوْ تُبْدُوهُ يَعْلَمْهُ اللَّهُ وَيَعْلَمُ مَا فِي السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد صدق
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah has power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time. And Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Moscow displaying the no-entry sign to almost 1,000 prominent Americans, including President Biden, reciprocating similar moves by Washington. Ukraine says it will never accept a ceasefire or a deal with Russia that involves surrendering territory. Public transport partially reopens in Shanghai as China's largest city moves to ease COVID restrictions. Hello everyone, welcome to World News. Here in the Iranian capital, I'm your host, Behruz Najafieh. Good to have you with us. Russia has blacklisted some 960 American citizens in response to Western sanctions. Leading Americans on the Russian Foreign Ministry's list include President Joe Biden, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, and Hollywood actor Morgan Freeman. The individuals are banned from entry to Russia indefinitely. The ministry says the sanctions are necessary to counter the U.S. attempts to establish, quote, a neo-colonial world order on the rest of the planet. Moscow has already blacklisted State Secretary Antony Blinken and Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin. Russia, however, says it remains open to honest dialogue and that it draws a line between the American people and authorities, inciting Russophobia. The Ukrainian president believes that there is only one way to resolve the ongoing conflict with Russia. That's diplomacy. Volodymyr Zelensky says that Ukraine did not start a conflict, but it has to end it. According to the official, even though Ukraine can be victorious on the battlefield, a breakthrough will only be reached at the negotiating table. Meantime, an aide to Zelensky has said that there is no way Ukraine would agree to a ceasefire or accept any deal with Moscow that involves surrendering territory. Mykhailo Podolyak, who is also Ukraine's lead negotiator, says making concessions would backfire because Russia hits back harder after any break in fighting. Currently, the negotiations are deadlocked, with both sides accusing each other of stalling the process. Now, Russia is pushing to take control of Ukraine's southeastern Donbas region after taking full control of the city, port city of Mariupol. As our correspondent Jana Miller reports, Russian forces are moving out of Mariupol, heading for the heart of the conflict zone in Luhansk. Take a listen.
I'm currently just outside Mariupol, where the last of the Ukrainian soldiers in the Azov battalion are finally surrendering. It's a great victory for the Russians to take Mariupol, but the Ukrainians are also saying that it's a victory for them. Why? Because those fighters at Azovstal were able to hold off or take up time in the Russian army. The Russian army had to surround that steel plants for a long time, stopping Russian soldiers moving elsewhere in the war. And in part, that's correct. When we were coming up this road this morning from Donetsk, we had to wait by the side of a country road for about half an hour as an entire Russian battle group moved past us. Dozens of tanks, dozens of supply trucks, all leaving Mariupol now and heading to where the fighting is in Donbass and Luhansk. Right now, there, the Russian army is trying to encircle the bulk of the Ukrainian army. They're having success using artillery. Even Zelensky, who normally downplays Russian successes, has said today that it is, in his words, hell in Donbass, as the Russians use artillery. Many of the Ukrainian soldiers in their trenches are dying without even being able to see the Russian army. This road here, we're heading back to Donetsk now. There's a straight road and there's a safe road. Because on the straight road, there is only about 4 kilometers away at one part is a village held by the Ukrainian army, and they often shell cars coming along. A reminder, the Ukrainians still hold huge parts of Donbass. But the Battle of Mariupol is over. The battle for Donbass and Luhansk is going to accelerate in the next few days.
In other news, Italy has increased its imports of Russian crude despite efforts by the European Union to reduce dependence on Russian energy. Russia has exported some 450,000 barrels per day of crude to Italy this month. That's more than four times as much as in February and the highest since 2013. Two-thirds of those exports are destined for a port in Sicily, where a Russian-controlled refinery is located. Lenders have stopped financing the refinery after the EU imposed sanctions on Moscow over Ukraine. And this has forced the refinery, which is owned by a Moscow-based corporation, Lukoil, to rely solely on supplies from its parent company. The growing crude shipments to Russian-owned refineries in the EU come as the bloc is working on ways to wean itself off Russian fossil fuels. The situation is escalating between Russia and the West as Moscow pledges a proper response to a bid by Sweden and Finland to join NATO. Hashtag Trending reviews the related developments posted on social media.
Hey everyone, welcome to another Hashtag Trending with me, your host Ali Reza. The West's confrontation with Russia is escalating as the two Nordic states of Finland and Sweden announced their desire to join the NATO military alliance. Stay with us to see some reactions to the story through the lens of social media. The bid by Finland and Sweden to join NATO has prompted Moscow's immediate response. Russia's defense minister says that his country will take adequate countermeasures against threats to its western borders, and that includes the addition of 12 new units in its western military district. The rising tension between Russia and the West has sparked a wave of concern among social media users. People are afraid that these dangerous developments may lead to a third world war, which would include nuclear confrontation. And now let's read some comments. The first one comes from Eggplant Shill. Sweden and Finland joining NATO is a massive escalation that threatens a blockade of Russia's access to the Atlantic. It does not matter if NATO calls itself a mutual defense organization. You do not back a nuclear power into a corner. Manuja, I think is how you pronounce it, said Finland and Sweden applied for NATO membership. Finland shares a 1,340-kilometer border with Russia. It won independence from Moscow in 1917. If accepted, their presence would instantly more than double the border between NATO countries and Russia from around 750 miles to around 1,600. Chuchi Face said Russia is to expand its military presence near its western borders as a retaliation against Sweden and Finland's application to join NATO. And over here we have a comment by Green Flame the Fourth. The U.S. that is afraid to engage Russia in a direct conflict militarily is offering to protect Finland and Sweden when they join NATO. What a joke. What the U.S. is cleverly doing with NATO is principally to ensure that all future wars are fought in Europe without being taken to U.S. soil. Meanwhile, Turkey has raised objections to the two Nordic countries' bid to join NATO, blocking the organization from proceeding with the accession process. Turkish officials have also accused both Finland and Sweden of supporting and harboring anti-Ankara terrorists. Our next batch of comments starts with one by the Third Rail with Omar. Finland and Sweden have been harboring the PKK, a group designated as a terrorist organization by Turkey, the United States, and the European Union. Now that they got the jitters from Russia and want to join NATO, everyone is upset at Turkey for raising concerns. Izhar Chowdhury said Turkey's opposition regarding Finland's and Sweden's accession to NATO is, in principle, correct. This move by the two countries is only to please the U.S., which will only escalate rather than end the war in the region. Linda Brown said it is absolutely staggering that Turkey, which has the second largest military in NATO next to the U.S., was never consulted about whether Sweden and Finland should join the military alliance. Of course, the people of Sweden and Turkey were never consulted either. Here we have a tweet by Bosonaugras Mabulamashin. He said, the biggest features of Sweden and Finland for NATO are that they are outposts of England and Germany. If Turkey can prolong the process when there is a danger of war, America must support it. I think the real subject of the bargain should be American strategies in Central Asia. Many believe that NATO's eastward expansion is the root cause of the problem as Russia sees its security at stake. They accuse the U.S. of trying to maintain its hegemony over Europe by bringing the war to European soil. The final batch of comments starts with a tweet by Mr. Brain and Backbone. The superpower in NATO is the USA. When the USA wants something, it forces it by using genuine reasons or by fabricating one. Weapons of mass destruction in Iraq with support of NATO. This is bullying. The fear of Russia that Finland and Sweden have is the same fear that some non-NATO countries have of the USA. Indiana Jones said the Russia-Ukraine war was planned well in advance by the dark elite, hashtag Davos, that pulls the strings of many Western leaders. That's the reason behind NATO's provocative expansion plus arming of Ukraine. The shady elite behind U.S. and allies sees Russia plus China as a threat. Ukraine is just a pawn. A.S. Francis has a tweet that reads, the expansion of NATO is a blatant provocation which may trigger another war by Russia with the former republics of the Soviet Union. The expansion of NATO will pave the way for Russia to restore the Soviet Union for security reasons. And our final comment comes from Paolo Pancho Ribeiro. The reason countries lobby to join NATO is not because of what the U.S. wants, but because they fear Russian imperial expansion, and this aligns with U.S. desire to contain Russia and maintain U.S. hegemony over Europe. And with that, we have come to the end of another edition of Hashtag Trending. Until next time, take care and bye-bye.
Now moving on, a new list released by British daily The Sunday Times says that there are a record number of billionaires in the UK, with the richest 250 people worth more than half a trillion pounds. Released in the middle of a soaring cost of living crisis, this year's list has new entrants, among them a UK government minister and his wife.
The UK, home to some of the richest people on the planet. The capital, London, alone has more billionaires than any other city in the world. That's all according to UK Daily The Sunday Times' rich list. In this country, it says, 250 people now own a combined $886 billion, enough to lift millions out of extreme poverty several times over. Many of the names on the list have been there for years. This year, though, two new faces. Chancellor Rishi Sunak, the man in charge of helping millions of struggling British families through the spiraling cost of living crisis, and his wife. The bulk of Rishi Sunak's wealth stems from his wife, the daughter of an Indian IT mogul. He also made his fortune working for Goldman Sachs and as a hedge fund manager in the past. We wanted to know how Britons felt about their chancellor now being one of the 250 wealthiest people in the country amidst the cost of living crisis that's pushing millions of people into poverty. First published in 1989, the Sunday Times Rich List bears the names of 1,000 ultra-rich people or families resident in the United Kingdom. 90% of those on the list are usually men.
At a time of record inflation, when many are struggling with energy bills, petrol prices, and food costs, this golden era for the UK's super rich, among them now a government official, does not seem to be coming to an end. Saeed Poor is up, London.
In other news, Palestinians in the occupied West Bank have held a funeral for a 17-year-old boy killed by Israeli forces. The mourners condemned Tel Aviv for its crimes. The victim, identified as Amjad Al-Fayed, was shot dead during a raid on Jenin refugee camp. Another Palestinian teenager was also critically wounded. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shataya condemned Fayed's killing, stressing that the international community should hold Israel accountable for its acts. The incident happened days after Israeli military killed Palestinian journalist Shireen Abu Akleh while she was covering a regime raid on the refugee camp. In recent months, Jenin has been at the center of tensions in the occupied territories. Mona Kandil says that most victims of Israeli attacks in the occupied West Bank in recent months are teenagers.
Since the beginning of this year, 20 Palestinians were killed only in Jenin. Some four of them are under the age of 18. This Palestinian who was shot dead this morning, Amjad Al-Fayed, he's only 17 years old, and even less than this. His friend, 18 years old, was seriously wounded during this Israeli military operation to Jenin. We can say that many of the Palestinian youths and Palestinian young men continue to be engaged in the different forms of resistance. And maybe in the last few months, we are witnessing more Palestinians are holding arms, trying to prevent the fully armed Israeli soldiers with their armored vehicles and tanks from raiding Jenin refugee camp. According to witnesses and according to Palestinian paramedics in the Jenin refugee camp, Amjad Fayed was shot by almost a dozen rounds in his upper part.
In the meantime, Israeli forces have used a Palestinian teenage girl to shield themselves against incoming bullets during a raid on the Jenin refugee camp. International children's rights group Defense for Children says the incident took place earlier this month when troops stormed the house of Ahed Mohammed Rida Mera to arrest her brother. A gunfight erupted and regime troops forced 16-year-old Ahed to stand in front of the military vehicle. Ahed recounts how bullets zoomed past her head before she could finally run to safety after about 2 hours when she fell unconscious. Defense for Children says Israeli forces attempt to shield themselves by putting the teenager's life in danger as a war crime. The group says it has documented at least 26 cases of Palestinian children being used as human shield over the past two decades. China's largest city of Shanghai is gradually emerging from a COVID lockdown in the wake of slowing infections. Four of the city's 20 subway lines will restart along with some road transport. This will form a basic network covering all central urban areas. Officials say that those who take public transport will have to show a negative COVID test within 48 hours and have a normal temperature. Some factories have also resumed operations, and residents in lower-risk areas are being allowed to venture outdoors. The city of 25 million residents reported more than 600 COVID cases on Sunday, almost all of them asymptomatic. Shanghai entered a strict lockdown at the end of March to combat a rising number of Omicron cases in line with China's zero COVID policy. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
supplication on Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure. From wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but Thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, Thou art the All-Forgiving, the All-Compassionate.
In the limelight.
Experts are warning of the worst global food crisis since the Second World War. It is a crisis that will have its severest impacts on the poorest countries and poor people in relatively wealthy countries, especially those already experiencing food insecurity, says Richard Heinberg, writer, in an article published under the heading, "The energy and food crisis is far worse than most Americans realize." Stay tuned for more. Everyone who owns a gasoline-burning car has noticed that fuel prices have shot up in recent weeks in the United States of America, and most of Americans have read headlines about high energy prices driving inflation in this country. But very few Americans have any inkling just how profound the current energy crisis already is and is about to become. This lack of awareness is partly due to economists, and those who depend on economists' readings of the leaves of Daily Data, a group that sadly includes nearly all politicians and news purveyors. Recently, an NPR staff commentator confidentially stated, "The only way to get gasoline prices under control is to get inflation under control. Anyone who understands recent events and how economies work will immediately realize that the statement is backwards. Energy prices are rising for specific physical reasons, most of which are widely reported." Those higher prices show up in economic statistics as inflation, a phenomenon that economists equate to a malevolent miasma that occasionally drifts into the economy from a mysterious alternate dimension. Of course, the goal of raising interest rates is to cool demand, which theoretically should help lower prices. But if prices for a particular commodity are rising due to physical shortage caused by novel circumstances or events, rather than increasing demand, then higher interest rates may offer little relief while bringing serious unintended consequences of their own. The comparison with leeches still stands. There's already enough bloodletting going on in the world. What we need now is sound thinking based in physical reality. Let's start with symptoms and identify clear, understandable causes. Then we will explore the current extent of the energy crisis and its deeper societal implications, especially with regard to food. Finally, we will look at the energy crisis in the context of a broader, longer-term view of U.S. economic system and see what things the United States leaders could do that might actually improve the prospects of ordinary citizens and future generations. What's making energy more expensive? Simple, physical scarcity resulting from pandemic, war, and depletion. Let's unpack each of these causes. The economic effects of the COVID-19 pandemic are old news, but they are keeping reverberating across the United States. A persistent worker shortage in the U.S., which you may have noticed at local restaurants, is also impacting energy companies and shipping firms. Further, the crash in oil demand early in the pandemic, when few people were driving to work, led to production cutbacks in the petroleum industry, notably in the United States of America, where fracking companies had been giddily burning through investor cash for years. Now demand has recovered, but investors are wary, and so companies are slow to drill wells likely to prove unprofitable. Raising interest rates, which will make it more expensive for oil companies to borrow money to fund operations, certainly won't increase the flow of oil and gas. The energy impacts of the Russian military operation in Ukraine are likewise straightforward and widely reported. Looming back of every other aspect of the oil supply story is depletion. If there is a shortage of oil, why not just open the spigots in other nations to make up the shortfall? Unfortunately, it's not that simple. OPEC's tired oil wells are about half depleted following decades of continuous extraction. Increasing the rate of pumping at this point would damage reservoirs, reducing the amount ultimately recoverable. The owners and managers of those oil fields are understandably reluctant to jeopardize their patrimony, and they're relishing the higher prices their product is selling for. So OPEC has barely nudged its output in response to shortages brought on by the war. The other potential source of increased supply is the U.S., whose tight oil extraction rates have soared in recent years. But most of the geological formations that have been the source of this bonanza, such as the bacon in North Dakota, are already in irreversible decline due to depletion. The world as a whole saw its peak output of conventional petroleum in 2016, following a long plateau that began in 2005. Oil importers, therefore, are largely out of options for replacing those lost barrels. Energy is essential for everything we do. It's not just a part of the economy. In a real physical sense, it is the economy. Therefore, whenever there is an energy crisis, it can quickly become an everything crisis. The links between energy and the economy are perhaps at their most transparent when it comes to diesel fuel. Trucks, trains, and tractors burn diesel. Therefore, when diesel gets scarce, supply chains start to seize up and food prices climb. Shipping costs were already soaring before the Russia-Ukraine military operation. Now, diesel shortages are erupting in South Africa, Sri Lanka, and Europe. Passenger trains in India have been idled. Thousands of buses, trucks, and cars in Cameroon have been stranded for weeks without fuel. In Sri Lanka, high energy and food prices have just helped bring down a government. At the start of May, inventories of diesel on the U.S. East Coast plunged to lowest seasonal level since government records began more three decades ago. Wholesale and retail diesel prices hit all-time highs. Among the millions of trucks that run on diesel are Amazon.com's roughly 70,000 delivery vans and semi-trucks. That company just announced a disappointing quarter and outlook due to largely to higher costs for trucking packages to customers. Most of Americans don't really care much whether Amazon turns a profit, but Jeff Bezos' current woes are echoed throughout industry after industry. Even companies whose business model doesn't include physical delivery of goods still depend on other companies that burn diesel. That's partly why global stock markets have recently seen massive sell-offs, but the market has yet to fully internalize the nearly existential risk posed by declining energy. The signs of energy crisis are everywhere. In Nigeria, Africa's most populous country, airlines recently threatened to cancel virtually all flights in response to surging kerosene prices. U.S. retail gasoline prices just hit a new record. And Europe is preparing for the likelihood of several natural gas shortages next winter. Saudi Energy Minister Prince Abdul Aziz bin Salman, speaking at the World Utilities Congress in Abu Dhabi in early May, said, "The world needs to wake up. The world is running out of energy capacity at all levels. It's a reality." One may question the motives of the Saudi minister. A so-called NOPEC bill making its way through the U.S. Congress would make it possible to sue OPEC cartel for price fixing. So the Saudis might like to heighten the perception that they are providing the world with an increasingly scarce good. Nevertheless, the statement is clear, direct, and supported by abundant evidence. If tractor fuel is getting more expensive, you might think that would put pressure on food prices, and you'd be right. But that's only one reason the cost of food is skyrocketing. Nitrogen fertilizer made from natural gas is seeing unprecedented price hikes, largely as a result of Eastern Europe crisis. In response, farmers everywhere are preparing to test the limits of how little fertilizer they can apply without threatening yields. Forecasts are bleak. For West Africa, reduced fertilizer use is projected to shrink this year's rice and corn harvest by a third. Costa Rica would see coffee output falling as much as 15% next year if farmers reduce their fertilizer application by one-third. For many years, organic and ecological agriculture advocates have argued that the world could produce just as much food without resorting to fossil fuel-based fertilizers and pesticides. But their alternative methods require knowledge and time for transition. Going cold turkey on fertilizer without planning and preparation would almost certainly lead to sharply lower yields over the short term. In response, the EU is now delaying rules intended to reduce farming's environmental impacts, including curbs on pesticide use. It also aims to put 4 million hectares of fallow land into cultivation. In sum, experts are warning of the worst global food crisis since the Second World War. It is a crisis that will have its severest impacts on the poorest countries and poor people in relatively wealthy countries, especially those already experiencing food insecurity. There will also likely be compounding social and political consequences, as pointed out in a new report by risk consultancy Verisk Malcroft, which notes that middle-income countries such as Brazil and Egypt will be particularly at risk for rising civil unrest.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Jean-Luc Brunel, a famous French model scout and fashion industry figure, has been found dead in his prison cell in what appears to be a suicide. Brunel was a close associate of infamous billionaire and sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein, who was also supposed to have hung himself in his cell. We've heard about Epstein and the sex trafficking and the victims who've come forward, but why has the media said nothing about the blackmailing aspect that Epstein and his close associate Ghislaine Maxwell were using underage girls to gather dirt on politicians so they could blackmail them? And what about the relationship to Israel's intelligence service, the Mossad? Today, we're going to try and answer these questions and look at the saga a little more carefully. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. On Saturday, February 19th, 2022, Jean-Luc Brunel, a prominent French model scout, was found dead in his cell in La Santé prison in what has been called a suicide. Now, you might be wondering, why should this be of any particular interest? Because Brunel was not just a big figure in the fashion industry, he was also a close associate of billionaire sex trafficker Jeffrey Epstein. Brunel stands accused of sexual assault and having partaken in alleged sex trafficking ring run by Epstein. To be frank, he was providing young girls to Epstein for sex. And for lack of a better word, he was a pimp. Now, according to one of the victims, Virginia Gouffray, Epstein admitted to her that he had, quote, slept with over 1,000 of Brunel's girls. And it was from Virginia Gouffray's civil suit against Epstein's close associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, that we know of Brunel's name as well. And this is one day that we see these court documents unsealed, one day before Jeffrey Epstein's death. Now, Jeffrey Epstein was known for living a lavish life and always inviting very prominent figures like actors and high-level politicians and businessmen to fly around with him on his private jet. And so Jeffrey Epstein would go and invite these people to his private islands, right, where they would have intercourse with underage girls that he had trafficked through his associates, such as Maxwell or Brunel, who were running these fashion and model agencies where they would get these girls from. And so following the revelations of this scandal, you know, people are starting to wonder, are these prominent figures, the politicians, the actors, all of these people we see in the photographs with Epstein, did they also participate in this sex trafficking ring? Because many of their names appear on the flight logs of Jeffrey Epstein's private jets. One of those names is, of course, Jean-Luc Brunel. The flight logs list him as a passenger 25 times on Epstein's private plane. And so who exactly was Jeffrey Epstein, the real Jeffrey Epstein? And why are there so many secrets surrounding this whole case? Now, back in 2008, Epstein pleaded guilty for soliciting a minor for prostitution. He served 13 months in jail, but unlike most prisoners who have to stay in prison, Epstein was given the luxury of being able to work out of his office 6 days a week. Now, one of the women who has come forward to accuse Epstein of sexual assault is Maria Farmer. When Maria Farmer was just a young art student, Epstein bought one of her paintings. She was recruited to work as his art advisor. And Farmer claims that Epstein showed her an entire system of secret video surveillance that he had set up inside his property with cameras in the bedrooms and the toilets. Now, Farmer was the first victim to officially report Epstein's behavior and abuse to the Federal Bureau of Investigations, the FBI. However, at the time, you know, the authorities just didn't seem to take her accusations seriously and there was no investigation. It wasn't just Maxwell, Brunel, and Epstein doing this. The victims have also accused many high-level officials, billionaires, professors, even the British royal family, Prince Andrew, of having partaken in this sex trafficking. Epstein provided them with young girls, which they abused. Now, earlier, I talked about the flight logs and how Brunel's name appears there. But you might be more familiar with former U.S. President Bill Clinton or Donald Trump, whose names appear multiple times on Jeffrey Epstein's flight logs. Now, Jeffrey Epstein was finally arrested on July 6, 2019, on federal charges for sex trafficking minors, and he pleaded not guilty. They then put Epstein in New York City's Metropolitan Correctional Center, also known as MCC, and they put him on suicide watch because he reportedly tried to take his own life. Now, when you're put under suicide watch, that means you're under 24/7 surveillance. But after an assessment by a high-level psychologist, Epstein was taken out of suicide watch, and they put him instead in a special housing unit, or an SHU. And so barely a month after his arrest, on August 10th at 6:30 a.m., Jeffrey Epstein is found dead in his cell by apparent suicide. And it turns out that the guards had fallen asleep and there's no camera footage. And with Brunel's suicide, the same thing. There's no camera footage. The cameras were not working. Now, look, there are many theories floating out there about Epstein's death, specifically because a lot of things don't add up. And even then, Attorney General William Barr, he himself admitted to some, quote, serious irregularities. There are also numerous suicide prevention experts who also expressed serious concern. Senior staff counsel with the National Prison Project of the American Civil Liberties Union, Eric Balaban, raised questions as to why Epstein's life was risked by putting him in this restrictive special housing unit, or SHU, specifically when he had shown suicidal tendencies. According to him, an SHU is just not an appropriate thing for someone who's shown recent suicidal tendencies. Now, I can recall as I was attending the extradition hearing of Julian Assange, one of the people testifying was none other than Maureen Baird. Maureen Baird is the former warden of that very prison, MCC, where Jeffrey Epstein killed himself. And she spoke about the prison conditions there, specifically about pretrial SAMs. However, she did note one thing, that Jeffrey Epstein was the first person to kill themselves at MCC since 2013. Now, to be honest, I cannot know how, you know, for sure how Jeffrey Epstein died, whether he simply decided to end his life because of all the pressure from the trial and the public exposure and the lengthy sentence awaiting him, or whether he was killed because he was too dangerous and the elites wanted to tie up some loose ends. But let me tell you something that we can verify. This wasn't the first time Jeffrey Epstein was in jail. As we were saying earlier, he was arrested in 2007. But how come he got off so easily? Well, it turns out that Alexander Acosta was the Miami Attorney General at the time. And while he was being interviewed a couple of years later for the position of Labor Secretary by Donald Trump's transition team, Acosta revealed that, quote, "I was told Epstein belonged to intelligence and to leave it alone." And now you see why he cut Jeffrey Epstein a non-prosecution plea deal. If all of this wasn't enough, you know, all of this horrible sex trafficking, it also seems that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell and Jean-Luc Brunel had ties to at least Israeli intelligence, if not also American intelligence. You know, Epstein had been known to brag about working for the Mossad, and Acosta just gives him a slap on the wrist because he knows that he's working with intelligence. Now, Epstein's longtime partner, Ghislaine Maxwell, her father, Robert Maxwell, is known to have been both a KGB and Mossad agent. You see, Robert Maxwell was a very, very famous media tycoon who owned 6 national newspapers in the UK. He also famously stole around £500 million from his own workers' pension funds. Now, journalist Whitney Webb, who's done fantastic work on Epstein, she's written extensively about Robert Maxwell's exploits as a Mossad agent in great detail. At one point, for example, Robert Maxwell acquired a company called Information on Demand, which was a front. It was a cutout for the Mossad. And they sold an Israeli piece of software called Promise, right? And this software was sold to governments around the world. And it had a back door inside it, allowing the Israelis to penetrate and spy on the very clients they had sold it to. So Robert Maxwell even sold Promise, this software, to a Los Angeles-based firm called Sandia National Laboratories, which provided Israeli intelligence with direct access to the core of the U.S. nuclear weapons program and nuclear weapons technology. And speaking of nuclear technology, it's also believed that Robert Maxwell is the one who tipped off the Israeli embassy in London about the Israeli nuclear scientist Mordechai Vanunu, after Vanunu had divulged the existence of Israel's nuclear program to the press. Right, Vanunu was subsequently kidnapped in Rome. They flew him to Israel and then sentenced him to almost 2 decades in prison. And when the issue of Robert Maxwell being a Mossad spy was brought up, because you have to keep in mind, he was also a member of parliament in the UK, so this was quite the scandal. And when this was brought up, no one would print it because the press feared being hit with a libel suit, right? So instead, what happened is George Galloway and Rupert Allison, who were both MPs at the time, they went and raised this issue in the House of Commons, exposing Robert Maxwell as a Mossad spy. And by extension, this allowed the British press to start printing about it without fear of reprisal or fear of being sued by Maxwell and his lawyers. And just a few weeks later, mysteriously, Maxwell died after allegedly falling off of his yacht. He was buried. He was buried with full honors at the Mount of Olives. And you know who attended his funeral? The Israeli Prime Minister and President, and at least 6 former and serving heads of the Mossad. Maybe that will give you an idea about how important he was for the Israelis, that all of these figures are attending his funeral. And so that's Ghislaine Maxwell's father, right? But if you thought the only connection here to the Mossad was her father, well, you'd better think again. Journalist Jeff Shalev conducted an interview in 2019 with an individual named Ari Ben Menashe. Ben Menashe was a, quote, Israeli consultant and former arms dealer who also served as a senior executive for Israel's Directorate of Military Intelligence from 1977 to 1987. So this puts Ben Menashe in a unique position to divulge about Epstein and also Maxwell, because he met them both 40 years ago when he was working for Israel alongside Maxwell's father, Robert Maxwell. And so in this interview, Ben Menashe is asked, quote, "You spoke about Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell as being part of Israeli military intelligence. Do you know specifically which unit?" Ben Menashe replies that, quote, "Because of Robert Maxwell, they worked directly with military intelligence. I don't know who they answered to." The interviewer then continues, "Would you say that she was an agent as well and in military intelligence as well?" Ben Menashe says yes, yes to both. And so Ben Menashe also makes another thing very clear, that Jeffrey Epstein and Ghislaine Maxwell, the entire point of their sex trafficking operation was to, quote, blackmail American and other political figures by specifically seeking out underage girls for their friends. And as for Jean-Luc Brunel, he used his modeling agency to traffic girls to Epstein, right? And unsurprisingly, he had an office in where? Tel Aviv, right? An office in Tel Aviv as part of his modeling agency with Epstein. And so here in this picture, you can see Brunel wearing a cap that reads Israel Army. Again, that's perhaps not the most incriminating thing, but do keep it in mind. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
Joining me is Graham Elwood. He's an American comedian, podcaster, and writer. He hosts a progressive YouTube show and podcast called The Political Vigilante. He's also the co-host of Government Secrets with Lee Camp. Graham has been covering the Jeffrey Epstein saga for several years now, which even resulted in his YouTube channel being demonetized. Graham, could you maybe just to start off give us a very brief overview of the Epstein case in the simplest terms so anyone can get it?
I have a whole Epstein playlist on my YouTube channel, and one of the most critical interviews I would ask people to watch is where I interview a former child crimes investigator, my friend Eric Oldenburg, who was on the Phoenix Police Department for 24 years, and he investigated online basically child trafficking and child pornography and pretty gnarly stuff. And I mean, he said, you know, anyone can be a pedophile, any socioeconomic status, any ethnicity, any gender, any sexual orientation. Sexual orientation doesn't even necessarily correlate. He said, but the people that can get away with it the most are the wealthy and most powerful. And that's what the Epstein case is. You want to understand how the ruling elites operate? Start paying attention to the Epstein case, because you've got, in the intelligence community, specifically CIA and Mossad, are their handprints are all over this. And, you know, like with these examples, just some basic stuff. So when Epstein was arrested in West Palm Beach, Florida in 2008, 2009 in that area, Acosta was the prosecutor, and he was told to... Epstein was a CIA asset and to back off. And that's why he gave him a very lenient case, a charge. Basically, he got got to fly, got to leave his prison every day and fly around and literally traffic and abuse girls.
And when you mention powerful people and the ruling elites, you know, you have a lot of pictures, photographs of celebrities and very rich and important personalities that have photographed with Epstein or Maxwell. And we've also heard of this black book full of names. Could you basically tell us what that is and why we see so many important people photographed with Epstein and people related, people in his entourage?
One of the things, and this has been confirmed in other places, one of the things Epstein would do, he'd have these parties with the wealthiest, most powerful people in the world. Billionaires, politicians, I mean, presidents, several different royal families, including the Saudis and the British royal family. And so this powerful person would come in. One of Epstein's butlers would say, hey, would you like a massage from a beautiful young woman? The guy would say yes. And it would be, they'd have sex and it would be a child. And they'd videotape it. Then Epstein would say, well, now I've got evidence of you having sex with a child. And they would then invest in Epstein's, he had some like fake hedge fund. So this is one of the ways Epstein got power. And this is why the intelligence community went, oh, this is an asset, because now we can use these videotapes as leverage. So what is so significant here, Richard, is when Epstein was arrested in July of 2019, we saw the video and the footage of the guys in the FBI coats dragging out, you know, not dragging, but like wheeling out on dolly trucks, boxes of photos, videos, hard drives, all this stuff. None of it. We have seen any of it. So what we have seen is just these little snippets. We've seen like the photos you've seen online. We've seen the flight logs. And I think the flight logs are very critical as well. They show stuff like Bill Clinton on his plane 26 times, Hillary on his plane two times. Trump was originally thought to only be on one time, but more flight logs were released at the end of December during the Maxwell trial, showing Trump was actually on five times. So to your question here, where is that information? Well, that is the reason why this stuff is getting swept under the rug, because the richest, most powerful people are on video. So that's why Jean-Luc Brunel is dead, is because he probably wouldn't play ball or had information or threatened to make a deal with the prosecutor saying, I'll give you these videotapes, give me a lighter sentence. And then all of a sudden, oh, wow, he's so distraught, he's going to hang himself. It's believed that Maxwell has so much information, and she's ruthless. She plays hardball, that she has, you know, I don't know, some people will call it like whatever you want, like a kill switch, basically. My belief is, Ghislaine Maxwell said, if I go down, you
sorry
go
to cut
down.
You off. I was going to ask you about the Maxwell trial, about Ghislaine Maxwell. I mean, how does she tie into Epstein? What's the relationship and why is she so important to this case? And what did you make of the trial that took place a few months ago?
We'll call her socialite, Epstein's gal pal, maybe even a recruiter. But according to several Epstein victims, including Virginia Roberts Giuffre and Maria Farmer and Maria Farmer's sister, Annie Farmer, she participated. So she's a pedophile. Like, let's be real clear here. And the media will not call Ghislaine Maxwell a pedophile. She is a pedophile and a sex trafficker. And all the women that survived said Maxwell treated them horribly. She treated them like trash.
Well, I mean, speaking of these political connections, one thing that I was really interested in asking you is that, you know, the connections to the Mossad, because you mentioned it briefly at the beginning. If I recall correctly, Brunel, he had one of these modeling agency offices in Tel Aviv, right? And we've heard many times that Maxwell is connected to the Mossad. Could you explain what that connection is and how this relates to the intelligence, specifically U.S. and Israeli?
Maxwell's father was a Mossad agent, and he had a mysterious death, jumped off a boat or some very sort of odd, mysterious death. So you have that. Then you have, as I stated earlier, Acosta said at an interview in 2009 that he was told to go easy on the prosecution of Epstein in Florida because he was this is Acosta's words, not mine, a quote CIA asset. Right. And then you have, again, John Kiriakou said this in my interview with him, And I asked him about the CIA. I said, does the CIA condone getting children for pedophiles? He goes, no, but if you went, I'm going to get a child for this pedophile, because if I get him children, then we can leverage that and use him as an asset. The CIA would go, okay, because they just want the leverage and the intel. And then seeing how, again, going back to Epstein's like fake hedge fund, these guys would donate money to it. And I'm blanking on the names. There was another big hedge fund guy. I can't keep track of all their names, but he donated or invested a lot of money with Epstein. And then women have spoken out against him. So what intelligence is doing, they needed people like Epstein to help them get leverage on all of these people. And they were like, look, Epstein, we'll let him have, you know, do whatever he wants on his plane and on his island, as long as he keeps feeding us intel. Until he kept getting, I think Epstein was one of these guys that was so egregious with it that then he became a problem and they got rid of him. From the intelligence standpoint, if they've got video of somebody or some evidence, then that person's easy to control. If that person is found guilty and goes to prison, they don't have them. They don't have, that person has no more power. They have no more leverage. So they need these key people to get all this stuff done. And they've got, you know, leverage on, you know, the Saudi royal family. They've got, and, you know, as I said, John Kiriakou said, this feels like the Israelis. He felt like Mossad, his first gut instinct as a former CIA operative was that Mossad was involved in Epstein's death. This all feels very coordinated and maneuvered by those two intelligence agencies.
There is one really important aspect, though, that the victims themselves have underscored, which is that Jeffrey Epstein used these girls to blackmail powerful people. And so, yes, Epstein and Ghislaine are very obviously depraved individuals who preyed on others. But they also did this to get dirt on the wealthy, on politicians, on businessmen, and anyone.